Welcome everybody to this new instance, to the second lecture on virtual machines. Last time we considered evaluation of expressions and found that there's a very easy way to generate code for it. And in principle it was like that. The code generation was a recursive procedure. First we generated code for the arguments, and then we generated code for the operand and for the operator, and the operator was translated into an instruction, and this instruction was meant to consume its arguments on top of, to find its arguments on top of the stack, consume them, and push the result computed by the operator. And by that, the resulting code kind of evaluates the expression, and at runtime evaluates the expression and leaves no trace on the stack besides leaving the result of the expression. So that was the idea. Now this kind of expression evaluation was a little bit was interesting from its operational behavior, but was boring from a practical point of view, because expressions built up from constants would be typically evaluated by the compiler beforehand, and so just the constant would be pushed on top of the stack. So in that sense, this kind of dynamic evaluation of constant expressions only occurs in a non-optimizing compiler. But here it was kind of just as a warm-up. Now it becomes expressions become interesting when they contain variables whose value is only becomes known at runtime. So that's kind of the interesting point. Now, variables, how do we implement variables? So at least in imperative languages, variables are considered as names of containers. One should say it differently. So a name is considered as a container for data. And so a variable, therefore, has a name to speak about this container. And the container has a content which receives the value and from which you, where you can put the value. And then later, if you look there, the value is still there. And you can, so you can extract the value and you can update. You can put into the container a new value. So now, therefore, if we want to implement that, we need these containers correspond to memory, to blocks of memory. Now, in the very simple, in the most simple situation, the data which we want to store away are of a kind of unit size. So this is, for example, in our case, an integer. So we consider. So we would take a memory cell. For example, in our store, every cell we said is able to hold a basic value. So this is an integer. So clearly, in reality, there are data of different sizes. Even basic atomic values could be of different sizes. So there are some data who have just one bit or a byte or a double byte or a word or a double word. Yeah, so or even larger. So there could be data of different granularity, and the compiler and the addressing scheme has to take care of to reserve if we have variables to representing containers for these variable-sized data items. We have the compiler has to take care of and has to maintain these differently sized portions of memory. Now, in our particular case, if we take it easy and take just the basic atomic values of one size, then it suffices that our memory management only speaks about memory cells of one particular size. So that is, these would be the memory cells inside the store. So long discussion, short result. So a variable corresponds then, so at least the variable of receiving and so representing a container of values of type int, then would correspond to individual memory cells inside the data structure S. Yeah? So that is like in this picture. So in this very picture, so, oh, let us do it in this way. So here is green. So this is a memory cell. We give it a name, set. So that is, now set allows to speak about this particular container, this particular memory cell, inside the program. So in the program we therefore have an occurrence of set, then we have to relate it to this memory cell. Now this memory cell, I wrote set in front of it, but we cannot put a tag to it. We have to, well, the computer or our data structure has to refer to this memory cell in a different way, namely by its index. So its array elements are accessed by means of their index. Yeah? So that is, this set corresponds to a number. And this number is not the content, but the location where this container sits inside the data structure S. Yeah? So that is, in order to, now we have two kind of ways how to deal with these containers. One is the program level. There we have the names, set, X, Y. And then we have the implementation, and there we have the indices. So this is in this perhaps 5, 6, 7. Yeah? So now we have to do, to relate these two fuse for the same container. And this relation, so this is, what the compiler has to maintain in order to generate code for the program, and that is what we call an address environment. Address environment, this is a mapping which maps each program variable to the address. That is the index into the array S, or the address, so this is kind of the number of the memory cell in the real computer, but in some sense the whole memory of the computer can be considered, at least conceptually, as a big array, and you access the individual data elements inside that array by means of the address or the index. Yeah?
But in reality, I don't know where my program is stored in the storage. So
still, you could have absolute addresses. And in reality, you also have addresses. And that is this mapping the compiler has to know. Or the compiler has to tell the loader, and so that the loader then knows. At some point, it must be known what is X.
So that or X is the relative address?
Now that is another point. Let me just, I have not talked about relative addresses so far. So that is kind of the absolute view. The more, slightly more general view is, and to be more flexible, that one kind of allows to start this counting at relative to some start address. So this makes it kind of a little bit more flexible. So if we have an absolute address, it's also a relative address relative to address zero. But you could kind of have also another base address, and then starting from that base address, count the relative addresses. And therefore, typically these row also, yet for the beginning, we kind of conceptually may think of, so for in particular in the virtual machine, we definitely have the zero, and that's kind of a zero. Yeah? So we have no problem with loading and knowing where the code is. The code is in a separate data structure, which is indexed separately. So therefore, we can have zero as an address. And that's it. So here in our virtual machine, we have absolute addresses. In the real world, it might be a different story. But then the trick with the relative address may help. Now your question. Please speak up a little bit.
I'm saying that the compiler doesn't know about the RAM size.
The size of the memory. Well, the compiler knows. So now here for our virtual machine, we ignore it a little bit. But in principle, yes. So there is something like that. And if you hit the border, then there will be something like Stack Overflow or a segmentation fault or things like that. So we will come to that later. So in principle, yes. And it is so even if so for example, Java, if you write a heavily recursive program, you will hit, you receive strange exceptions telling you that you have kind of exceeded your stack space. That things like that happen.
Hmm?
So here, this is a virtual machine. So there is this is kind of you configure it, and then you have it. In the real world, for example, in OCaml, I know you can extend the stack space as much as you like, as far as much as your computer offers. So it's kind of a runtime it's a kind of an option which you put into the code. Okay. Once again, a variable is a container. And this means that there are two ways how we can look at a variable. And this means that the same X denotes different things depending on the context in which it occurs. So one thing is if it occurs on the right-hand side of an assignment. In that case, if we write here, for example, Y, what do we mean? We mean the content of Y. While on the left-hand side, the X, this means something else. It is not the content of X, it is the name of X, the container itself. Because here we want to, here we state, please put the value contained in Y, incremented by 1, into the container X. So you see, here, additionally, you have one additional kind of you might call it dereferencing. Here, you not just want the container, but you want the content of the container, and here you just want the container itself. And these things are distinguished by calling it the R value, R like right hand side, and the L value of a variable, which is the address. The L value is the address. Yeah, this should remind you to the left-hand side of an assignment. There are programming languages which make it a little bit more clear. And if you write X, then it's always the variable, which means the name of the address of the container. And if you want to have the content, you have to write a bang before it or so, something like that. This is if you think of references in which are such correspond to that variable in languages like OCaml or SML. Yeah, but here there is this little confusion that you have to refer that the context determines what is meant by a variable X, by the name X. Okay? So here is again, here I wrote it again, what I told you now made it clear, but I guess maybe you have known that already before, but this is important because we have to generate code now for it. And so we have to distinguish these two situations. We cannot treat it in the same way. We cannot generate the same code for the right and the left-hand side. And therefore, it is important to recall this basic fact here. And that is, for that reason, this context-dependent, please, could you please close the door? It's a little bit loud outside. Thank you very much. So children's noise might be nice and relaxing, but not during a lecture, I guess. Okay, so, and the code which we generate for the X or for any expression on the right-hand side, this we will call code R. Where is it? Here. Here, this is this code R thing. And code L for an expression will result in the, so if E denotes a variable or something which may hold data, then the code L, code generation, so this is a function which produces the code for a program expression. Yeah? Code L takes a program expression, this E, and produces a sequence of instructions. And this code L should do it in such a way that it returns the address, and code R should do it in such a way that it produces the content, the real, the value. Yeah? And now this code generation function takes the expression E, but also it takes another argument, which is the address environment row. And that is clear, because if there's an X inside this expression, okay, so X, nice to have, but which address corresponds to it? Where should I take the value from? This is extra information which we have to supply to the code generation function. So that is the row, which is the second argument. And now you see, oh, there's this code R function, nice, and then there's the E and the R, the row, and they sit one after the other. What does that mean? So this is kind of maybe, this is the way how functional programmers write function application. They like to write it in that way. First comes the function, and then simply the arguments are combined with the function. So they sit just one after the other, and this means row R, code R is applied to E and then to row. Okay, is there confusion about that, or are you functional programmers enough to understand this kind of code? Who does not understand that kind of... Everybody's clear? Okay, so then it's fine. Okay. So that's it, and now you see, so in principle, or at least tried to explain here with this example, here, so this was when I talked about R value and L value, actually I only talked about R value and L value of a variable. Now, why should there be more complicated things which also have an L value? Why should there be... It's always a variable which has an L value or an R value, or is this wrong? Yeah, too complicated. Simply, programming languages supply us with more complicated things than just basic variables. There's also arrays, there are structs, there are pointers. And then you kind of, by pointer and array indexing and pointer dereferencing and so on, you can refer to, by means of a very complicated expression, to a particular memory cell, to a particular container. And this container then has an address and a content. So therefore, in general, it is not just a name which corresponds to a container, but it could be also complicated expressions which represent a container. Yeah? And therefore, complicated expressions can have an R value and an L value. So that's it. And then the other thing is, which is to note, and which I have kind of put here, we will encounter these, and we will discuss in detail for also these very complicated expressions, what is the R value, what is the L value. So this is just to remind you that such beast exists. What is important here, also kind of recall that not everything is a container and thus has an L value. For example, if I have an expression x plus 1 and x is an int variable, then x plus 1 is not, it's just an intermediate value. It has no location where it is. There might be, this is, So this giving it no location means that the compiler is free to evaluate this expression wherever it likes. And it need not provide a memory cell to hold this intermediate result. Yeah? There could be in some cases, this x plus 1 could also be an L value, and in opposition to what is written, or in contradiction to what is written here, namely in which situation. Now come the C experts. Please, C experts, save me. Hmm? Why? Yes. That's true. So there is something if x is a pointer, and then x plus 1 could be an address. But this is an address. But the address is the R value of this expression. Yes?
Yeah, but this is common for array, for accessing arrays.
Yes. So this kind of, there is such a thing like pointer arithmetic, which allows you to add values to pointers. Okay. Now, so let us now try to define these functions, code R and code L, at least for those cases which we have seen so far. So no pointers, no bad things, only variables, arithmetic operators, and arithmetic expressions built up by means of operators and variables and constants. So let us start with the constants down there. So here, if you have a constant Q, what is the code R of that? Well, it's just code R should, this is a code generating function. So it takes the expression and returns a sequence of instructions, which at runtime has the effect as when the Q is evaluated. When Q is evaluated, we expect Q to show up as a result, which means to show up on top of the stack. And the instruction to do that, this was this instruction load constant, load with this Q operand. Yeah, so this Q can then kind of is in the code here. Okay, so now comes, that was what we had last time, and then we also had this binary operator thing. And so here is kind of the formal way how we did it. We said, okay, please, first, if you want to have the value of the expression, the code R, then please first evaluate the first argument, please then evaluate the second argument. Now this juxtaposition means concatenation of strings. Yeah? So this is, I first to output the sequence of instructions for E1, then the sequence of instructions for E2, and then I put the sum. The instruction for adding, and this is add. And now this is for all other binary operators as well. And for unary operators, we said, okay, it's in this sense completely analogous. We first produce the sequence for the argument, and then we put the instruction for the negation. And it is and this one consumes the intermediate result, which has been stored on top of the stack after evaluating the E, and puts the result. Okay. So now that was what we had last week. Now let us make another color. Now green. What is new? Now comes an individual name X. So what should we do with it? Now we wonder a little bit, because we have no instruction to do it. Huh? What do we mean, what should be done? Well, for the code L, for code L we have the instruction, sorry. So I'm at the code R, we do not know. But the code L we know, because code L means we have to return the address of X. Yes, on top of the stack. How do we return the address of X on top of the stack? Okay, we take our address environment, we look up the value for X there, this is a constant, say 5, and then we put 5 on top of the stack. So in this sense, code L is something which we still can do with our set of available instructions. Now, if we want to, but that is only gives the address. Okay, address is useful, but only for the left-hand side. We have nothing so far to kind of retrieve the value which is stored in that container at that in this memory cell at this address. How do we do it? So either we could kind of say we can't do and commit suicide, or we say, okay, if you don't have it, we then provide a new instruction to do it for us. So that is what we do. So what is, so we are able, we saw that we are able to push on top of the stack the address of a memory cell. So the address of, the address of the memory cell corresponding to X. And then what we only need now is an instruction which consumes this address on top of the stack and replaces it by the content of this memory cell. So this is kind of the dereferencing operator, if you like. So, and we call, we have to give it a name, I give it the name load. So this is the instruction load. Okay? So it has an argument, it consumes the argument and replaces it by the result, which is the content of the memory cell. Okay? And then the code R of X consists, is translated into two instructions. The first one is push the address of X on top of the stack, and the second is the instruction load. Okay? Now that is brings us that allows us to evaluate right-hand sides of assignments, but it does not allow us to implement assignments themselves, because we now for the assignment itself, we not only need to retrieve the value from a memory cell, but also to store something there. And now, how would this store be implemented? So storing could be done in this way. Assume that storing needs two arguments. You have to know where to store, and you have to know what to store. So assuming first you have these two things on top of the stack, then you could say, okay, please store. So that is this instruction store, and which takes this value here and puts it into the stack, into the memory cell, pointed to by the top element of the stack. Now here, I did it in such a way that the value which is stored remains on top of the stack. So this is in some sense stupid, because storing in some sense means you have two arguments and no results. So why should I leave the content of the value which I have stored, why should I leave it on top of the stack? Well, why should I do that? It's a bit weird. This is because our virtual machine implements C. And in the world of C, an assignment is an expression. This is different from languages like Pascal or Modular or other languages, where an assignment stores away the value, and then there's leaves no trace on top of the stack. But in the C world is a different world, and there an assignment is an expression which has a value. And it is the value which is stored inside the container referred to by the left-hand side of the assignment. So here, if the value to be stored away is 13, then this 13 also is the value of the assignment. So it must be left on top of the stack. And so, therefore, for that reason, we have designed this tailored store instruction. Yeah, this tailored store instruction is in such a way that it not only does the storing, but also does this returns the value which is stored away on top of the stack. And for that reason, we also put first the value of the right-hand side on top of the stack. So therefore, the code R for X equals E is first evaluating the expression on the right-hand side, then evaluating the expression on the left-hand side, where, please note, the value on the left-hand side, the value on the left-hand side is evaluated with this different code generation scheme. For the left-hand side, we only evaluate, use this code L to generate code, which means for the case of a variable, of a plain variable, that we, that this is just load constant rho of X. Yeah? So here we have the sequence of instructions evaluating the right-hand side to a value. Then comes this load constant of the variable for the right-hand side. And then comes this super-duper store instruction, which stores away the value which we have evaluated for the right-hand side and also leaves it on top of the stack. Okay? So let me just once more. So this store is defined in such a way, this is no rule of nature or something, but this is our effort to model the semantics of C by means of our by means of instructions of our virtual machine in the most simple way. Yeah? We could have also used the more simple store instruction, which kind of stores it, just stores it away. Then we would also have to need another instruction, for example, to load it from that place or doing such a simple stupid thing, which kind of makes the code more ugly. And so we simply did it in this way. Yeah? And that is, so we took the freedom that we can, since we define the virtual machine as we like, to do it in such a way that it fits well, that it goes well with our programming language. Okay? But here you see also a little bit of this flavor of the of design of virtual machines. You have a certain freedom to adapt to the features of your programming language, and you should make use of it. And so that is what we do here. So now let us look at a concrete example so we have to see how it works. Otherwise, we don't believe that it works. So here is our little example, x equals y minus 1. How would we translate it? How would we translate it? So we need, for that, we need an address environment. Otherwise, we can't translate it at all. So the address environment tells us, for example, X has relative address 4 and Y has relative address 7. So then we first have to evaluate the right-hand side, so Y minus 1. So the first thing is we have to compute the R value of Y. So for that we have to load the address of Y, which is 7, and then we have to, so this is load constant 7, and then we have this instruction load to get the value which is stored there. Then we have to subtract 1. So for that we have to generate code for the second argument of the minus, which is this load constant 1, and then we have to load to generate code for the minus, which is this one. So now we have the code for the right-hand side of the assignment. Now we have to produce, we have to produce the L value for the left-hand side. This is X. So the L value of X is load, is the L value of X is 4, and we produce this by load constant 4. And then we make a store, and then we have the code for the whole assignment. And actually, it's not any code, but it's the code R for the full expression, because it leaves the value of the expression on top of the stack. Okay? A question?
Is
What?
Load C is...
Load C? No, load C means simply load constant. And you give a value of it, and then it loads this constant on top of the stack. And it is because of this row that we know that X sits here and Y sits here. So therefore, this one loads the L value of X, and this one loads the L value of Y. Only because of the row. So without row, we would be doomed. And if there were a different row, these two values would be different. Okay? Now we see something which is a little bit of a nuisance, efficiency-wise. Because accessing a variable and storing, writing to a variable is a very frequent operation. And here we have to do it in two ways. We first have to load this constant, and then we have to load from this constant. And that is kind of like an extra interpretation thing. So it would be better if we could directly use an addressing scheme, which takes the compile time value 7 to do the addressing. And that is, you could think of it as that we kind of merge these two instructions, load constant, say, 7, followed by a load, into a single instruction. We merge them together into a single instruction, load AQ. And this A should remind you of absolute. So this is absolute addressing. So this means, please load the value from the address queue. Or in the particular instance which we have here, load A7. Yeah? Means load, give me the push the value of address 7 on top of the stack. And likewise, we would have a direct way of storing away. So please store away the value on top of the stack into the memory cell with address A. So therefore, we join together this load constant with address Q. The two instructions load constant, say 4, with the store following store operation into the store absolute 4. Okay? So now this is kind of an abbreviation which you could consider more or less, it makes the code a little bit shorter, but it has no semantic meaning. Yes, it has no semantic meaning, but it can provide quite a lot more efficiency. Why? This, using these two instructions, means that the interpreter of the virtual machine instructions really has to take the constant, put it onto the stack, and then to use this load from there. If I have this particular instruction, the implementation of the virtual machine is free to implement the store absolute queue in any way it likes. So this queue never must be put into the stack, on top of the stack, and then used for an indirect store, but could be directly mapped to a machine instruction doing the storing away at this particular address. So this could be much faster, yeah, by a factor of something. Yeah. So therefore, using these specialized instructions has an impact onto the efficiency of the virtual machine. Yeah, because it allows for more efficient implementation of these basic operations of program execution. Okay, but once again, this is efficiency-wise a useful thing. Semantic-wise, it should not make a difference. Actually, it makes semantic-wise a little bit of a difference. Why? Because stack consumption is a little bit less, and so stack overflow happens a little bit later. So in this sense, it is an improvement, as it provides less stack overflow. A little bit less. But this is perhaps a minor point. Okay, so now we see that an individual assignment is no particular challenge for us anymore. So let us go now to bigger entities in our program. And so the next thing after an expression is a statement. Now a statement, you have a statement and sequences of statements. So if you have an expression, then this is not a statement. Because what is a statement? A statement, at least philosophically, is something which leaves no trace at all on the stack. So the stack pointer should be, before and after execution of the statement, the same. Now this is not the case, But this is not the case for an expression, because an expression returns a value, so the stack pointer increases. So now if typically what people have is, what people write, is things like that, x equals x plus 1, and we have seen this is an expression. This leaves a trace on the stack, namely an element, the value of x plus 1. So therefore you have to put something to throw away this extra element on top of the stack, and this is the semicolon operator in C. So the semicolon is not just something to, it's not just a separator between individual statements, but it is kind of a pop. Please throw away the value which has been pushed by the last expression. Okay, so this is also different from other languages, like for example Pascal or Modular, where the semicolon is just, a separator. But that is a little bit of a stupid thing and a little bit kind of not completely logical, because you can also write another semicolon in C. Now what should that throw away? There is nothing to throw away because there's no expression. So will it then decrement the stack? No, it will have simply no effect. So in that sense, the semicolon kind of is a little bit a weird thing. It depends on what comes before, and if nothing comes before, then it has no effect. Yeah. Okay, so now, but here is this thing that what I said, if I have an expression and I want to turn it into a statement, I have, I should kind of switch to the right tool, like this one, then I have to turn it into, I can turn it into a statement by writing the semicolon operator. And that means the semicolon must be translated into something. And also, since I tried to explain to you what it did, what it does, so this immediately shows us how we should do. We should kind of pop the stack to throw away the value of the expression. And now we have no instruction so far to just pop the stack, and therefore we provide such an instruction, and this is this instruction pop, which simply takes decrements the stack pointer. Very simple instruction. And so this means also if you kind of write 5 semicolon, then this is perfect C. It simply means that 5 is put on top of the stack, and then it is popped away. I guess this is something which a compiler typically also immediately throws away. Okay, any questions on that? So that was on the easy side. Now let us see how we can produce sequences. What do we do with sequences of assignments? Is it complicated or is it easy? Now clearly it turns out, so at least it's the most, code generation and our code generation schemes do not try to be as smart as possible, but as obvious as possible. So that is the idea of code generation, to map as directly as possible the semantics of the program into the code. So therefore, and conceptually, in the people have sequences of assignments, of statements mean, please execute the first statement, then the second in the sequence, and so on. Just do it in sequence. And now our implicit assumption is, if you have a sequence of instructions, please execute them one after the other. So therefore, the sequencing in the program means that also we have to do the sequencing in the code. So that is, if we have, so here is the corresponding, I should go back one slide. Here you see, and I kind of did not speak about it, but I should do it. Here is something strange. What is strange here? Yeah, what is strange here? There's no index R or S. Because here, a statement is not an expression, so therefore a statement does not have an L value or an R value. It has no value. So therefore we need a new code generating function for this type of syntactical entities. Yeah, so this is this function code. It operates on statements. And here in this case it calls the code generation function code R because there's an expression inside here in this particular case, and then concatenates the sequence produced by code R, concatenates it with the single instruction pop. Okay? So I hope you are not confused with that. Different types of things may have different functions, may require different functions, and for general statements we have this code function. Okay? And the same code function also can be applied not only to statements but also to statement sequences, because these also do not have an L value or an R value. And so the easiest thing is if we apply this code generation function code to an empty sequence of statements, then what should be the result? So you see nothing here, and this means the empty sequence. So then also you produce no output. Now if you have a longer sequence, then you simply in the same order as the statements occur in the sequence, you produce the code. So therefore, this is done by this recursive procedure. Yeah? And again, this juxtaposition here is just concatenation of the outputs. Okay? So that was easy. So it probably cost us just 1 minute. And now let's go for the more interesting things. Namely, when control flow changes. So that is clearly there is something to do. And so far we have no possibility to affect the control flow. But we recall what the main loop of our interpreter, how it behaves. It takes, where does it get the next instruction to execute from? Well, it always looks into the PC and then use the PC to index into the code array and retrieve the element from there. So therefore, if you want to have not the next instruction to be executed, but some other instruction to be executed, we could do it by simply modifying the PC. And that is how we implement a jump. So if you have a go to A, for example, then this means we should know what instruction corresponds to this program location A, and then we put that location into the PC, and then we would continue from there. Yeah. So jump A therefore means simply put A into the PC. Yeah. Now I wrote here A, and if we write any kind of assembly program or other program, we would do also write such symbolic labels A. It is, but that's not in every programming language. There's, for example, at least some dialects of good old BASIC. So there you had to give numbers. And clearly nobody can keep track of all the numbers of the perfect, precise lines in your code. So you had to use, for example, 100, 200, 300, in order that you can, if you insert a new line, then you could write 150 and so on. Also these numbers then are kind of symbolic and do not correspond directly to the number, to the line in the code. It is very difficult to keep to remember the precise line of codes, because humans at least tend to change their minds every 5 seconds. And cancel out lines and insert new lines, and so it's a complete mess. And so if you really write such a program with jumps and with putting the line numbers there, then you would never get it correct. So that is, any meaningful assembly language provides you with the possibility of symbolic labels, which you can write in front of every line of code, which is kind of invariant of what other lines you put in between. And then you can and allow you to use these. But before you kind of ship your assembly code to the target machine, there will be something. There will be a little processor, which kind of then replaces the symbolic addresses by real addresses. Now here for us, we also will kind of use always these symbolic addresses, but keep in mind that there is such a, that there will be a process, there will be an assembly processor which kind of replaces the symbolic addresses then in the very end with the absolute addresses of, or with something which can be directly interpreted by the machine. Okay, so that was the direct jump, jump A. And what is, so this means that always when we kind of reach this point, we will continue at the place marked with label A. But sometimes you also, you do not want to have the, this direct jumps are not sufficient for realizing more complex control flows. Typically, you also have if-then-elses to deal with, so you have conditional branching. So how would one do conditional branching? Somehow, you, a condition leaves a Boolean value on a condition is evaluated, so it's an expression, and it leaves a Boolean value on top of the stack. Whatever a Boolean value is, but in our world, the Boolean value is, in the C world, the Boolean value is also an integer. And, as we agreed last time, the convention is that zero is false and everything else is true. So we therefore need a possibility to jump depending on whether there's zero on top of the stack or not. And for that, we kind of provide a particular instruction, which is this jump at zero. So this only jumps if it finds a zero on top of the stack. So the zero on top of the stack is the argument to this jump zero, jump at zero instruction. So therefore it is consumed and it is therefore removed from the stack. Yeah, so the condition is an expression. It leaves a value on top of the stack. The jump at zero consumes this value left on top of the stack. And then, well, if this value was zero, puts the target, which is this A, into the PC. The target address into the PC. And now if it finds something else on top of the stack, for example, a zero, then it will not affect the PC, but still, as this value on top of the stack is the argument of this instruction, will consume this argument and remove the value. Yeah? So therefore, the value on top of the stack is removed in all cases, but only in some cases, the PC is modified. But this means the branching is in such a way, if the condition is true, then the execution will simply proceed with the next instruction in the row. And only if the condition is false, there will be a jump to another position. This we have to keep in mind, because when we want to realize conditionals in our language. Yeah? Okay. And here I have listed to you again once more this thing which I have already briefly discussed. We use symbolic jump targets here for easiness of implementation and writing down the code. But we keep in mind that later these will be replaced by absolute addresses. That is also an interesting point of view. There is some kind of choice what it means when there is when this A is replaced by a physical address. say by 15. Then there is again a choice what this 15 means on the real physical machine. There are at least two meaningful choices. The one thing is that this 15 is really the code address, the code instruction with address 15. So this would be the absolute addressing. But there's another possibility, which I called here the relative addressing scheme. This means that if I replace this I with 15, then this means this A is the location A has distance 15 to the current location. Why should one use such a weird scheme? But the other one is, well, I don't know whether the other one is worse for if branches.
And
so what was your suggestion? Yes, it's more mobile because then typically if code is shipped around, it is then shipped, for example, a bunch of procedures will be shipped around. So the code inside a procedure, so where these jumps are, will not kind of be affected by this shifting around, or will stay together while this shifting around. And therefore these jump targets are still valid. So if you use absolute addressing, you have to know where really your code in the program is located. And that might not be available at compile time, because it could be loaded perhaps on top of something. It could be library code, so several of these things could be loaded together before the program is run. Yeah, so it's kind of more robust if you have these relative addresses, because then your code is inside more mobile, as you liked to call it. Okay. Yeah, this is what I called here relocatable. And also the other thing is also, which is perhaps a minor point, but it's also an interesting point, because then smaller addresses are sufficient. Because again, you have this problem, this jump target must be located somewhere in the code. And if you kind of want to squeeze your instruction in a particular memory, in say 32-bit, and you have a code which is large, then these 32-bit will kind of may fill up the whole address, and then you are kind of doomed. So what can you do? And here is what you can do. If you use these relative addresses, an individual procedure will not take up all your memory space. Yeah? So therefore, smaller addresses are better for store, then, because then you only have to provide less bit for these jump targets in your code. So this is a useful thing. Okay, now we have the prerequisites. Now let us see how we can use these jumping things to translate conditionals. So here is one. The most simple form, which I can conceive at least, most simple. So here it is. It is a one-sided conditional. So if E is prime. So what does that mean? It means that E should be evaluated, and if it is non-zero, then S prime is evaluated or is executed, and then program execution continues after that. So how would one do it? Now, in principle, we do it in this way, as we do will proceed virtually for every complex programming construct. This complex programming construct has constituents, namely here this expression, and here the body. And we saw what we do is we have to generate code for E. We have to generate code for S prime. So we do it. And we place, so these are sequences of instructions. So we somehow have to arrange them. So either one is on top or the other one is on top. So for, this is a choice. And then that we could, so for example, here we, one would say, okay, E has to be evaluated first. So we put it on top and we, the S, the code for the S prime we put behind. Okay, but that is kind of the mandatory, but this is not yet sufficient to realize the programming logic which we want to have. Namely, that the S prime is only evaluated if E is true. So therefore, we have to now decorate these two, we have to decorate these two sections of code with extra instructions or whatever we require, whatever we find useful, in order to realize the control flow. Yeah? So let us look how it looks like. So the, now we have to, here kind of the structure of the code, and we have to now experiment what to do. So the first thing is the situation when the expression E is true. Or it say when it is false. Yeah, so that is, it returns zero. How then the code for S prime should not be executed. That means we have to jump behind this code. So that we could do by inserting in between the two portions of code this instruction jump at zero. Yeah, where the jump target is the first address behind. Okay, so this is the guess for one flow of control. Now let us see whether this is the right guess. What happens if the evaluation of E does not return zero? Okay, then we come here to this instruction and the value is, say, 5, which is on top of the tag. What does jump zero in this situation do? Okay.
Nothing.
It pops the 5. And continues with the next instruction. And that's correct, because then we should execute the code of S prime. So we execute the code of S prime, and if we did it, what do? We continue with the code behind. And that's exactly what we want to have. So here, magically, the whole thing what we have to do is to insert this instruction, jump at zero, in between the two sections of code. And so the target address of this jump at zero is the first address behind the body of the conditional. Okay? So that's it. So this was a clear success story. So we saw it is not so difficult to come up with this scheme. So we get more self-confident, and we try for the next complicated programming construct, which is now this one. Now we do not have just one, but a two-sided conditional. So now, if E holds, we have to execute S1, but not S2. And if E does not hold, we have to execute S2, but not S1. So let us again try. So the first thing is we considered the situation when this one returns the value 0. So this means S1 should not be... I'm too quick. I should first say, now we have three portions of code, the code for E, the code for S1, the code for S2. And again, these three portions of code must occur somewhere in the code if we put them in sequence. And again, we leave some space in between and have to decorate it in some way with jumps or whatever so that the flow of the program logic is realized correctly. Okay? So therefore, code for E here, code for S1 there, code for S2 here. And now we have to put something in between. So now everything is, what do we have to put in between? So therefore, let's again check what do we have to put after the condition E. So the first thing is assume that the code for that the evaluation of this code returns the value 0. Okay, then definitely S1 must not be executed, but we have to execute S2. So therefore, that is in some sense similar as before, and the job is done by using this jump 0 instruction here. So this is our first guess. Put jump 0 here, and we jump now to this to the beginning of the else part. Now the else part is executed in this case, and then we have to continue with the code afterwards, so everything is fine. Yeah, because here's the code afterwards, and everything is fine. Yes? So that's good. In this sense, for the if the condition is false, the implementation or this part of the implementation is already fine. Now let's see what happens if the code, if evaluation of E at runtime will return the value -5. Yeah? So it is not true. No. So it is true. It is not false. It is not zero. It's not false. It's true. This means the then part must be evaluated. This is the S1. Okay. So, but that jump at zero is still the correct choice. Because in this case, this kind of thing is not, is now no longer relevant. We indeed, in this case, we just proceed with, the instructions in sequence, and that is the code for the S1. Fine. We execute it. Now, once we are done with the S1, we are here. And so now, ahead of us is the code of S2. But we should not bump into S2, because after the then part, we do not continue with the else part. We continue afterwards. And we continue always afterwards. So therefore, we have to insert here something extra. But this is unconditionally. We always have to jump behind S2, so therefore it is an unconditional jump. So our toolbox is already rich enough to realize this control flow. We put this jump here, and the jump target is the instruction, the first instruction behind the else part. And that's it. And in the end, we come up, therefore, with this code scheme, and you see, so here is this jump at zero with the address A of code of the else part, and here we have a jump B, which is an unconditional jump, and this B is the first address behind. Okay, so that's then our scheme, and then this works in every situation, whatever expression E is, whatever S1 is, whatever S2 is. Okay? So it was not so difficult. It was actually pretty easy, given our toolbox and given our kind of exploration of the different behaviors of what we want to have. Okay, and then now we can already try to experiment what that means if we have a particular statement like this one. Yeah, so this means if x is greater than y, we subtract y from x, and otherwise we subtract x from y. Okay, so now we have three portions, the condition, the then part, and the else part. The condition is here. The then, no, that was wrong. The condition is here. The then part is here, and the else part is here. And in between, we see that now we see the decoration in between. So here, after the condition, we have this jump at zero, and between then and else part, we have this unconditional jump. Yeah, and now you see. As I have written that down, that by looking at the kind of jump statements we have in the code, we can in some sense recover the structure of the original program, because we know the condition is terminated with this jump at zero, and then the separation between then and else part, this is just the jump B. And we now have acquired sufficient awareness, we see that there's another a structuring element which allows even to single out assignments. How do we single out assignments? Well, assignments are typically terminated always with this pop thing. And therefore, if we have a sequence of assignments, we just look for the pops, and in between we have the assignments. So the structure of, in some sense, the structure of the code becomes immediately, so with this a little bit of skill, completely transparent. Also, it looks at first sight as an arbitrary sequence of weird instructions. Now, this is our virtual machine code, but it is the same if you look at the code of produced, say, by GCC or any other compiler. If you have a little bit of experience and the optimization level is not too high, then you look at the code and you single out these kind of jump statements, what kind of jump statements are there, then you can really recover what kind of code is there. So this reverse engineering works pretty well because compilers generate code in such a structured way. This is a little bit obfuscated by all kinds of optimizations, but if the optimization level is not too high, the structure is still quite visible. Okay, now we could also go into dive into the details how the condition is translated, the x minus y, and that you see here the x is greater than y, but that is now no surprise anymore. This load A4 loads the value of x. This load A7 loads the value of y, because 7 is the address of y and 4 is the address of x. Yeah, and this greater is the instruction for the comparison. And also here you see this one is computes the right-hand side, the r value of the right-hand side of x minus y, because load A4, this is loading x, load A7 loads the value of y and subtracts. And the same here for the other right-hand side of the assignment. And then in the first assignment must store the value into the x. This is by store absolute 4. And the other assignment must store in the value into y, which is the store absolute 7. Yeah? So now you see it's very easy, and we can read it in some sense in the same way as we can read the original code. Okay? Now let's go for let's experiment whether we can let's see whether we can deal with while loops and other forms of loops as well. So what is a while loop? So a while loop looks like that. We have a condition and you have a body, and the condition is evaluated, and if it's true, then the body is evaluated. And once the body execution of the body is done, we return to the condition and recheck the condition. And as soon as the condition becomes false, we jump out of the loop. So that's what we now have to realize. And again, we follow our general principle. We have two constituents, E and the body S prime. So we place somewhere in our code we have to place somewhere the code for computing the R value of E, and somewhere the code for the body S prime, and now I have to do this jumping around. So what is to do now? What kind of jump instruction do we have to place between code E and the code for S prime? So if the value of E returns false, what do we have to do? As I said, we have to jump out of the loop. Okay, so therefore, the address which we have to provide here must be the first address behind the loop. This is the B. Yeah, so we jump here. Now then the question is, what happens? This means in particular, when the evaluation of E return the value different from zero, we will not jump out, but just continue. And that is fine, because after the jump at zero follows immediately the code for the body. And that is what we have to evaluate then. Okay, we evaluate the body. Now what do we do when we have done the body? We are done with the body. Well, in this case, we have to iterate. That is, we have to go back to the condition. So this we have to do always, no matter what happens. So therefore, we now need an unconditional jump here back to the beginning of the loop. And so this gives us immediately this form of this way how to compute how to generate code. First, we mark the beginning of the loop because that is the place where we have to jump back. Then we generate the R code for the E. Then we have this jump at zero B, and this B is the first address behind, and then we have the code for the body. And at the end of the body, the jumping back to A. That's it. Okay, very easy. So let's see here another example how to, where we can check whether what we did is meaningful. There is this, here is this fabulous while loop. And again, so we see it's a while loop with a condition and a body. So that means we need a code for the condition. Here is the code for the condition. We need a code for the body. This is here. And we need a little bit of jumping around. So this jump at zero after the condition and the jumping back at the end of the body. And so that is, here we jump to the beginning, and the jump at zero jumps out. And again, we see the organization of the jumps is very unique, and it is in this jumping back kind of is the characteristics of a loop. So we can, just by seeing this kind of jumps, structure of jumps, we see, this must be a while loop. So even if we know not where it comes from, we immediately can recover the control structure just from looking at this these instructions. And again, as I said a few seconds ago, these pop things kind of indicate the assignments. So here, this must be an assignment. So we have two assignments in the body, and we now may just check what is whether the condition is correctly implemented. A should be greater than zero. So how do I get the value of 8? So we check for, so the relative address is 7. We load apps, this, we use this load A, 7, to get the value of A. We load the constant zero and we compare for greater. And likewise, this C, this incrementation of C by 1, so we need to know what is the relative address of C. So this is 9. So this gives us the value of C. This gives us the 1. So we add them, and then we store the value in C, which means the address, the memory cell with address 7 away. And then here there's this pop because it is an assignment. Okay, and the same thing can we do here. Here we load A. Here we load the value of B. Here we subtract. And here we store away into A. Okay, so now we can do while loops also. And now, but there are many other kinds of loops also. But one more question. Is there any question? Have you seen such kind of things already? Who has seen that already before? So you saw that? So then it was, where did you see it? Assembly programming in, where is it, in ETI or where? Okay, so then you see it. It is the same principle, but here with a kind of for another machine, namely for this virtual machine. I don't know, did they also have this kind of recursive definition of code generation schemes, or did they have kind of ad hoc, you do it like that and that's it? Okay, so now let's see what we do with for loops. So for loop is kind of consists of, so the typical way to write down a for loop is like that. You have three expressions and a body. And it is meant, so the expression E1 is meant to be executed before the while loop, and the expression E2 is the condition of the while loop, and the expression E3 is injected after the body of the into the while loop after the body S prime of the for loop. Why this weird kind of syntax? Why not using just while loops? Any idea?
Actually, you could translate the for loop in a while loop and then put up a schema for the while loops.
Yes, we can do it, and that is what we do here in principle. But the question is, why do we provide the syntax of a for loop at all? It's just, yeah, it's in some sense it's syntactic sugar, as we see here, not quite, but almost. And it is a very common way of thinking and programming. Namely, it is really so that you often have kind of an iteration variable, which you initialize, and then you have you count up this variable and until you hit the border, and then you kind of leave the loop. And this is kind of nicely, so this E1 then would be the, for example, if the variable is I, then you would kind of initialize with I equals 0, for example, and this E1 would be I less than 42, and the E3 then would be I plus plus, for example. Yeah, so in this way, this is a typical behavior, and then the body here does not have, is just what you, the real computation, and you do not have to bother with the increment, with incrementing the loop variable. So in that sense, it's a common pattern how programmers write their code. And then therefore, in other programming languages, there were such kind of for loops. But they were restricted, or they are in Pascal, for example, it is restricted that it is just an integer variable which you really increment or by some step or so. But there are other forms of these such type of iterations, which is not an integer which is incremented, but something else which is updated and checked. You have an example? When you traverse a list, for example. Yeah, this is a common example. And therefore, the C language designers thought that it might be useful to provide this more general form of a for loop. Okay, so now, having kind of settled this, let us see if the for loop really corresponds to this... It's just syntactic sugar for this one, then we can implement it quite easily. We just take that and apply the schemes which we have. This means the E1, a semicolon, is translated into that. Then the while loop, the body here is this one, and the code for the while loop, therefore, is this one. And so, in essence, this gives us the scheme for the for loop. So the scheme for the for loop in this way is the right one, but there's a little bit of these two things are, in fact, it's just a more or less a side remark, but these two things are not completely the same. What is different?
Compiler does, or the C language specifies the condition in the while is empty.
Ah, yes. So that is the one point which you kind of hint at, and that is that sometimes you can kind of have it think like that. That is what you say?
Yeah, exactly. That eventually
resorts. Yeah, yeah. So that thing like that, or you could write it even that way, and for that one has to provide dedicated translation schemes. That is one point. Very good. And then there's another point, and this is, you know, that there are not only these kind of structured things in C, but you have also these breaks and jumps. So what does a break mean in a loop, in a while loop? You jump to the first instruction afterwards. Okay, so that works fine, even if for a for loop. So for a for loop, if you have a break there, you jump to the first instruction afterwards, everything's fine, it's the same. It would, because both would jump to this B. Now what is with the continue in a while loop compared with the continue in a for loop?
Jumping.
In where?
Continue.
In which loop? In which, for a for loop or for a while loop? Yes, so there's a difference. In some sense, the continue jumps to the end of the body. Now, the end of the body of the while loop, the end of the body of the while loop is this place. But the end of the body of the for loop is this place. And this is different from the end of, as you said. So you jump simply in the for loop, if you make continue, jump to the end of the S prime. This means this E3 will still be executed. But if you did this translation mechanically, you first translated to this while loop, then the continue would not execute the E3 anymore and would directly re-inspect the condition. So therefore, there is a little bit of caution, but this kind of gives us, it is only this relationship between for loop and while loop only gave us the way how to set up the general scheme, and then one has to take care of in both situations what precisely is meant with the continue. Okay. Let us now go to so we have 3 minutes left. There is one more thing. So this is, we had now the main branching constructs of C, but there's with the exception of one, and this single one which we have not yet looked at is the switch statement. This is an interesting thing, because what is the idea here? Assume that you switch on an integer number, and the integer assume that it ranges between 1 and between 0 and 2000 and 1023. Yeah, so this is more than 1,000 alternatives, and if you kind of would realize such wide branching by means of if then else, you could do it. But even if you do it in a balanced way, this means at least you have to do 10 comparisons and tenfold nesting of jumps. And that is kind of expensive. And so the idea is that depending on the number, if you want to branch, depending on the value of an integer or an enum, which is internally the same as an integer, then it might be reasonable kind of to use this number which you branch on to kind of control your jumping. That means one would kind of have a table of jump targets and then use the number which you of the switch, which is provided by the switch statement, to select the alternative directly. So this saves you the tenfold branching on the tenfold nesting of conditionals and gives you a quicker access to the chosen alternative. And that is in this is an important concept and requires a new jump instruction. This is this index jump, which we will look at not today. Today time is over, but we will look at tomorrow, because tomorrow we continue and meet again a quarter past 10, same at the same place. So, yes?
The exercises,
I think I have not seen, so Stefan will put it into the Moodle, and I don't know whether he has already offered certain times, and he will also provide time slips there. So please look into the Moodle for that, for the exercises. Oh, thank you.